Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome back to Web Sleuths Radio. After a three-week vacation, two Sundays in a row, I was working with Mark Class and Class Kids for their fabulous print-a-thons, and Mark is going to be our guest tonight as well. And then last Sunday, I was actually in Los Angeles getting ready to testify in federal court against a crazy psycho person, and we'll be talking about that as well. But first of all, Web Sleuths Radio is brought to you by a wonderful organization called DreamCatchersForAbusedChildren.com. This is a nonprofit organization where their mission is to educate the public on child abuse symptoms, interventions, and preventions. Visit them at DreamCatchersForAbusedChildren.com. And like I said earlier, Mark Class will be joining us tonight, as well as true crime author Donna Kaufman. We'll discuss the Baby Lisa case and the case of Bessie Shockley, a missing five-year-old from Glendale, Arizona, a very tragic case. It's hardly getting any media. And little Jesse is African-American, which there is part of the problem. The media just seems to ignore African-American kids, but not Mark Class and not Web Sleuths. We'll be talking about her case as well. But first, I'm going to start out with the very strange case of Robert Cook, not to be confused with the good Robert Cook, whose daughter Rachel has been missing since 2002. No, this Robert Cook is a bad guy, and from now on, I will call him Felon Robert Cook or Felon Cook. Fair warning, we're going to be talking about impacted fecal matter. It's important to the story, so there you go, just letting you know. In 2003, I get an email from some guy, random guy. He says, "My friend's in prison, but he solved the JonBenet Ramsey case. Had something to do with her neck being broken and the lights, the Christmas lights on the staircase, on the garland that burned her." It was just a ridiculous, absolutely stupid thing, and I didn't pay any attention to it. I just thanked him, said bye-bye. That was in 2003. 2008, I get a phone call. And this was a time when my number was not readily available. You really had to know what you were doing and search for it. Anyway, it's Robert Cook, and he says, "Do you remember?" And I said, "Yes, I remember. Your friend said you were in prison." And he started getting really excited. He's like, "Oh, I can't believe that we're talking, and this is so great. We're going to work together." I'm like, hold on. What were you in prison for? And he said, "I was in prison. It was a government thing. They just framed me. It was just a misunderstanding." And I said, "Okay." I said, "Well, I'll tell you what. Let me think about it, and I'll get back with you." So an internet search turns up Robert Cook actually robbed an armored car of $250,000 and then tried to hire a hitman to kill abortion doctors and tried to hire people to blow up abortion clinics. Even the extreme right-wing abortion people, I mean the ones that are scary, they didn't want anything to do with him. That's how crazy this guy was. So I write him an email and I say, "You know, Robert, you weren't honest with me. I don't think we're not going to work together. Good luck with everything. Sign it my name." Then I get this email back. This is in June of 2008. In the subject line, it says, "See you soon." This is from Felon Robert Cook. Subject line, "See you soon. Trisha, it is amusing how in your last communication with me, you wished me luck in my endeavors, but then banned me from discussing my theory on your website." Oh, that's the other thing. I wouldn't let him join Web Sleuths or Forums for Justice. "Let's see, you banned me from discussing my theories on your websites with others who discuss the Ramsey case and are interested in the case. I am not fooled. I know that you are now part of the conspiracy against me to prevent me from being credited with solving the Ramsey case." Yes, I have time for that. I love to be in conspiracies and to stop people from solving cases. "You and the rest of the pieces of SHI ** who are part of this conspiracy should know that your efforts are in vain. I will succeed, and it isn't I who needs the luck, trust me. Very soon, I'm going to initiate Plan B, and no one would really want me to initiate this plan if they had any idea what it entails. Let me just say that I am willing to do absolutely anything to inform the general public of the truth about the death of JonBenet and expose the conspiracy against me. Abso-effing-lutely anything. Robert E. Cook." And then he adds this disclaimer: "Nothing in this communication should be misconstrued as a threat or an expression of intent to commit an illegal act or to violate my probation." In other words, he basically just threatens to come and kill me, but it's not really a threat, and, you know, it's just not. I don't know what he thought, but that disclaimer plays a part in my testimony, and you're going to be shocked at what happened with it. So now I'm quite scared because I know this guy has the initiative to back up what he says. I mean, look what he did. He robbed an armored car. He tried to hire people to kill abortion doctors. You know, there's no I was frightened. So I took it to the FBI, and the FBI agent was very sweet and very upset. He said, this guy needs to go back to prison for this. He's violated his parole. And the federal marshals wanted him back in prison. They all knew he was dangerous. So his parole officer goes to him, yells at him for emailing me, and then says, you're on thin ice. So basically, all she did was piss him off more at me. Didn't revoke his parole. It was really bad. The FBI agent said, if he were me, he would get a gun. That's exactly what he told me. So I made my son stay with his dad for a while. I got a gun. And I got a bigger dog. And I waited and waited. What he ended up doing, this felon Robert Cook, is he ended up going on a place called Topics, T-O-P-I-X, which is just a wild forum, millions of people posting, no moderation, nothing. And he just started posting a bunch of junk about me, and I don't pay any attention to it. But then he starts posting threats to the Boulder Police Department and to a judge in one of the civil cases in the Ramsey case. And scary stuff like Armageddon is coming, it's going to get physical when I get to Boulder, just very, very scary things. So I see this. And if you're ever on Topics, you know, when you post, it posts your location, like the city that you're in, it'll post. And it shows him posting in Los Angeles, and then a couple of days later, it shows him posting in Las Vegas, like he's on the move. So I'm panicking now, and actually this was in 2009 when this happened. I'm panicking, and I'm calling the Boulder Police, I'm calling the Sheriff's Department, I'm calling the judges' chambers, I'm calling everybody, saying, these guys, this Robert Cook, felon Robert Cook is making threats against you, and he's a dangerous guy, you need to do something. Well, they totally ignored me, and you know why? And this is something that I face all the time. It's because of the misconception that if you're involved in a true crime website, you're some sort of internet crazy. And I fight that all the time, that somehow we're just, you know, bored people that want to put our fingers in everything and cause problems and be idiots. And that's just not the case, as we know. Fortunately, that is slowly dissipating, and I'm not seeing it as much. But I know that's why they didn't call me back when I said I was with Web Sleuths, because they didn't understand. Finally, I get a one-line email from Detective Ron Gossage, who says, thank you, we got your email, something like that. And I went, okay, good. Now I can sleep at night knowing I've done my job. That's the last I hear. This is in 2009. A few weeks ago, I get a call from an FBI agent. Apparently, Robert Cook started harassing and stalking Commander Kim Stewart. And if you are familiar with the JonBenet Ramsey case, you'll recognize that name. It's somebody that Steve Thomas thinks very highly of, and she's an excellent police officer, and she's made commander. And I didn't know all the details then, but after the trial, I found out that he had been calling her, and then she wrote him a letter, said, please don't call, just email. He kept calling. They recorded them, and they were just very threatening emails, basically. So he was charged with two counts of interstate threats, making interstate threats, and one count of internet stalking. So the prosecutor wants me to come and testify about my email and my warning the police and about how dangerous this guy is. So they fly me out to Los Angeles, and Donna Kaufman, true crime writer, co-author with Dr. Cyril Wecht on many, many books, was there to greet me. And Donna, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Thank you for being my bodyguard and buying lunch.
Hey!
Yeah,
only the best for you.
It was great. We got to walk by the Occupy LA people. It was a pretty amazing experience. But Donna was able to sit in the courtroom, and she'll be able to fill in a little bit more. But let me tell you, this is very, very interesting because, and I want to talk to Mark Klass about this, we hear about the rights of the criminals a lot. And I used to think, oh, they've gotten better about that. I mean, yeah, they do deserve rights. They deserve a fair trial, but they don't deserve more rights than the victims or the prosecution. They deserve equal rights. And Mark, let me just sidestep here a little bit. In your case, it was horrible. In Polly's case, the man convicted of killing her, they gave him all kinds of rights to say things and do things. Is that correct?
Well, let's be clear. They don't give them rights. They have
rights that are guaranteed in the Bill of Rights of the United States Constitution. The problem is that the word victim doesn't exist in the United States Constitution. Therefore, we've got no constitutional representation in a court of law. Remember, prosecutors represent the state. The defense certainly gets their representation, and they have all of these rights that are written out for them. But victims are well, with the exception of things that are done in the states, and, you know, I'm here in California, and we have a good list of victim rights in the state of California, but ultimately there's no equity, and their rights will always trump ours until there is a Victims' Rights Amendment in the U.S. Constitution. But you're exactly right, Tricia. I mean, he got to act out in unbelievable ways in the courtroom. He flipped the double bird at one point in the courtroom. He accused me of molesting my own child at another point in the courtroom, and he was allowed to do these things, and his right to do so is protected.
What upset me, I mean, there's so many things that upset me about Polly's case, but I remember looking at back then, and they removed you for responding to him, and I thought that was wrong. They should have removed him. I don't even want to say his name, the Beast. They should have removed him rather than removing you, and that has always just really bothered me.
Yeah, I agree.
You know,
I totally agree.
It was just crazy. And this, and Mark, this case I'm about to tell you about is nothing compared to the hell that you went through. This is almost comical in nature in some ways. So, but I know you understand, especially being in California, even though this was a federal case, you're going to understand completely what I'm saying here. Okay, so now I'm in L.A., okay, and they start prepping me for my testimony. And they tell me the judge is really stern. And I said, okay, and I really have to keep myself in check because I'm a smartass, especially if someone's being a jerk to me. That's how I respond. So, and they start going over my testimony, and I'm just talking about what I did and everything. And then we start talking about the posts on topics, all these threats that he had made. And I said, you know, some of them, I don't even think they're there anymore. This was before I contacted River Rat and Cherokee to help me look for them. And she, the prosecutor, Megan, said that, you know, she didn't think she needed them, but if I could look them up and find them and send them to her, that would be great. So we did that. It was a wonderful conversation with the prosecutor, myself, and the FBI agent. Everything looked like it was going to go smoothly. And so here we go. The next day, I found some of the postings, the threats that he made on topics, not all of them. I should say River Rat and Cherokee did, but enough that it could help her. So I get to the court the next day, and we're shoved in this little witness room, and it's all the witnesses. We're not allowed to talk to the case, and it's like a lot of people from the Boulder Police Department. So I'm in there with them for, you know, 5-6 hours, dying to ask them questions about the JonBenet Ramsey case. We had Sergeant Trujillo in there, Commander Kim Stewart, a couple of other cops, and I can't remember their names. But
Kurt
I didn't.
Euler.
Who?
Kurt Euler.
Oh, Kurt, was he one of them?
Yeah, he was one of them. And there was another one, too. I'm blanking on his name. I'll think of it.
Think of it. And that one other one, and he was involved in the JonBenet Ramsey case as well. But I thought, you know, I do not want to perpetuate that.
Kurt Foster. Sorry.
That's it. Kurt Foster. That's it. I didn't want to perpetuate that crazy internet person trying to interfere with a case, so I thought I will not ask them a thing about the JonBenet Ramsey case, and I didn't. We weren't allowed to talk about the case, and then this little old lady comes in. She's really cute. She's having trouble with her cell phone. She's one of the witnesses. I help her with the cell phone. Come to find out, it's felon Robert Cook's mom, and she was going to testify, and then he decided not to call her, so she got to watch. But anyway, I felt really bad for her because her son is just out there. So I'm sitting in there, and they're going through everything. And now, Donna, maybe you can pick up what happened in the beginning of this case.
One of the interesting things that happened is felon Robert Cook, no E on his last name, decided to represent himself.
So, that's right.
You know, for a guy who is really out to intimidate women from his previous case to this one, that's yet another example of how thrilling it must have been for him to be able to call you and Detective Commander Stewart
That's right.
To answer his questions. The judge, I'd like to point out, is named Stephen Wilson, and he was, I would have to say he's extremely biased, as judges go. He was, it's one thing to be, careful to make sure that there's nothing that's reversible if there's a conviction. This guy was just rude. At one point, the defense, because they were discombobulated, and he had another paid attorney there to kind of help him. They were looking for an exhibit number. And Megan, the prosecutor, said, oh, that's number 43. And the judge snarled at her, who asked you? Are you kidding me? So that's the setting of who's in the courtroom.
Exactly.
So the first person up was Kimberly Stewart, who is the Boulder detective commander. She has come up the ranks. She's been there 21 years. She was in on the JonBenet case from the get-go. She was asked how many tips have they gotten from 2009 forward, and that's 780 tips.
780 and tips on the JonBenet Ramsey case for 2 years?
Exactly.
Okay, stop
in
one there.
Years.
Let me just say, we're talking about the trial of convicted felon Robert Cook, who was convicted of internet stalking and harassment, and he thinks he solved the JonBenet Ramsey case, which is what brought all of this on. Donna Kaufman, true crime author, was in court that day, and this is what we're talking about. Okay, go forward.
Taking notes. And as you remember, from 2002 to 2009, the case was handled by the district attorney. Now, if they also heard from Cook, we don't know about it. That was not germane to why we were in the courtroom this time. Prior to that, because Stewart had been part of the early investigation from 1996 forward to 2002, it was 5,000 and some tips. So they have had their fill of tips. He started sending her emails that were – first he started on Gossage, Ron Gossage, who was a detective there. And then pretty much like no one wanted to talk to him, so he would start with these weird, aggressive, more and more imbalanced emails. And I think he derived a special pleasure from finding a female detective. His theory initially was that his cellmate confessed to him. So he first hired a lawyer to try to market that into something that would make him money. And when that failed, a book or movie or whatever, he kind of stewed and then came up with this this idea that she was, I don't know, it was not quite explained whether he thinks that she was strangled by a light cord, but he spoke to Boulder Ramsey housekeepers who said, that previous Christmases there was a string of lights on the railing of the staircase, and this year there weren't. So that made him think, well, that's why there wasn't. They got rid of it because she burned herself and she was strangled, assumingly she was strangled, by that string of lights. I've solved the case.
What a brilliant
the
man.
Glory
brilliant
man. And, of course, he's looking at the same silly marks that the defense had said are from the stun gun, which was every which way disproved. Those are not thermal marks or burns in any way, so they weren't from the light. They weren't from the stun gun. They were scrapes or, little abrasions on her. And they're all over her body, so it's like nothing that has anything to do with lights or burning. But that was what he obsessed on. So he thought he would really clean up and, solve the case. So he could not understand that anyone would say, okay, thank you for your information. We'll contact you if this is the thing that solves the case and we agree with that. He did not understand that the case is not solved until the BPD says it's solved. And
right.
you even said that on the stand. And
I
by
did.
The way, Tricia just rocked as a witness. She was
oh.
concise, Woo-hoo. Clear. She knew everything about the case and everything about his harassment of her. She wasn't dramatic. She knew that this judge was touchy, so she just gave the necessary info. And even at that, he was still jumping, saying, don't give us narrative, just give us yes or no answers, which is ridiculous.
Right.
But she really did a great job on the stand, a great job to represent Web Sleuths and Forms
Thank you.
For Justice.
Thank you.
Yes. Well, it's true. By the way, I want to say hi to River Rat, too. I owe her that for a long time ago.
Yes.
So anyway, the first person called was Kimberly Stewart, and she was cross-examined by the other side, by Megan, I don't know her last name, the prosecutor, who did a great job. And then the next person that came up was, oh, and let me tell you about the jurors. I flipped out a little when I saw the jurors because there were 14, two of which were alternates, and there were all men except for two on the jury and two that were the alternates were females. And this was a case that was not going to go more than 2 days, so the idea of alternates was kind of absurd, and as it happened, they were not needed. But when I saw basically a 10-2 split for a violence toward female case, I had real problems with that, and I was not sure that they did a good job in jury selection. They talked about his cell phone calls, and he had left messages that were threatening to all the cops, saying, you know, basically, as you said, accusing them of being in on a conspiracy, saying, I'm going to go postal, someone's going to get hurt, and why are you lying and doing this cover-up, and, you know, that kind of stuff. So,
mm-hmm.
And the F word every few minutes, which, you know, shame on his mom. So then Tricia came up, did her work in a wonderful fashion. The next witness was a woman who didn't seem like she would be his friend. Her name was given. I won't give it out. But there was no explanation as to how she knew the defendant. And he did not make that point when he cross-examined her. All we knew from her testimony, very limited, was that she saw him once every month, and that she told him, you're obsessing about this case. You really need to back off and stop making threats to all these people. And so basically that's all we know about her. Now you could think, well, were they dating or what? Well, a smart juror might think, once a month, I bet that's his parole officer, and that's what it was. But they couldn't say that. So the next person up was Detective Tom Trujillo, who is who's been with the Boulder Police for 26 years. He also spoke of the 780 tips since 2009, and the 5,000 prior to that. He did something that no one else wanted to do, which is he spoke to Robert Cook for 40 minutes one time. So, which proves, you know, no good deed goes unpunished, because he is trying to tell him, look, this is how we do it here. You know, we'd be real happy to solve this case, and anyone who brings us a tip that really solves it, that person, we're going to be happy to recommend to crime solvers that they get a reward, which nobody mentioned what that amount was, and I asked somebody afterward, and there's a $1,500 standing award for solving the case. And so he basically said, but this is how it is. You give me information, I don't have to give you anything in return. But if it happens that you solve the case, you'll read about it. You'll hear about it in the media. and you will know you solved the case, and we can talk then. But until then, you know, thanks and goodbye. So, well, that wasn't what this guy wanted to hear. He wanted to be in on the case and help the police, you know, take it over and do it right. There was also something Kimberly Stewart said, which was in many of the phone calls that he made for her, and some were played in court, and he just sounded like a viper snarling and spitting and swearing on her voicemail. I mean, you come into work and you listen to your messages and you hear something like that, you know, I'm surprised she wanted didn't turn around and go home.
Yes, but, no kidding.
You know, he said at one point that he had a sister. He spent time in Aurora, Colorado. He said he had a sister who had an Italian exchange student staying with her, and there was some connection there where he thought that person was culpable. And it wasn't explained, but it sounded like one of those theories that we had all heard about someone else at some point. But there was nothing to it. But the Boulder police, as they follow up, did make contact with the sister, and the sister said, yeah, I had someone staying here, but she's long gone. She had nothing to do with the case. And they investigated and found that was true. So, you know, maybe that's just more women that Robert Cook is mad about.
Was mad at, yes.
Yeah, he'd throw them in the mix as well. They put out, because Kimberly Stewart felt personally threatened, and they put out a be on the lookout for, and they got his, you know, his face and his details, and they gave a printed copy to every Boulder cop. And on cross-examination, she mentioned, you know, yes, she was nervous about being, you know, attacked by this guy. Who knows what someone deranged could do? And then the prosecutor said, well, what about when you were walking to your car? Do you have, you know, you don't need a pass to get into the building when you're walking to your car, right? No, I don't. I'm on my own. What about when you're at home? No, I'm on my own. So made the point that this guy who had a Jones against her could get her anywhere. It doesn't have to be that he's going to somehow get through the
police department, right?
That you need at the police department. It could happen anywhere. So right. That kind of made the point.
Donna, I need to just... go ahead. I'm sorry, go ahead.
And the judge basically, she was asked, did you do a bolo on anyone else? And the judge found that irrelevant.
That's just bizarre. So, well, I just want to talk just briefly here so we can get to the baby Lisa Irwin case. But it was so fascinating because when I got up on the stand to talk about Robert Cook and the prosecutor, felon Robert Cook, started to ask me questions, you know, I was just answering normally. And the judge threatened to have me removed off the stand. Remember that? He says, if you don't stop with these long answers, I don't know how he put it, well, we'll just have you removed. And I'm like, my holy mother of God, I haven't done anything. And then I looked at his face, and I am not trying to be facetious, I'm not trying to be funny, but I swear to God, he looked just like my dear departed father when he was extremely constipated. He really did. I felt like if I could have just given him a Fleet enema and said, go in the back room, go for it, he would have come out and felt better. But he was the meanest, the rudest, and yet when Robert Cook got up to question me, he bent over backwards. Now, one thing I forgot to mention, we were not allowed to say anything about his past at all.
Right.
Now, one thing you have to remember, it's prejudicial, but one thing you have to remember, the reason why I was so frightened when I got this email was because of his past, you know?
Right.
If I didn't know who was sending it, yeah, I'd be concerned, but I wouldn't be frightened. So anyway, Robert Cook gets up there, and now he has cherry-picked parts of his posts on topics. He doesn't
read
the whole...
Yeah, now he's a witness. Yeah. He's taking the defense. He's testifying for his own defense, and his other attorney is doing the questioning.
And he thinks, now get this, he thinks he deserves $50 million. This was said when you weren't there, Donna. This was the next day.
Right,
he deserves
on the second day.
$50 million for solving the case. He deserves his own a book deal, and he should be a talking head on the Casey Anthony case. This is how delusional he is. And when he was cross-examining me, he was having me read bits and pieces of these posts that he had made on topics, and he'd say, "Now, is this threatening?" And that's not a yes or no answer. No, it's not threatening if Joe Blow said it. Yes, it's threatening because you said it, and you've cut it off, half off, so you don't have the whole post here. And when I tried to explain that to the judge, that's when he just got furious with me. You know, and I'm thinking, they want the truth, but he's not letting me tell the truth. So I just kept tap dancing with this Robert Cook, and I tried not to admit that these were just, you know, nothing posts, because they weren't. On the face, if you knew nothing about it, maybe, but only because you had half of the post. And I had sent the post to the prosecutions, and I don't know why. Maybe they couldn't use them because they couldn't be verified. I don't know. But I just think that the prosecutor wanted to get me off the stand as quickly as possible because the judge was so irritated. But now get this. Felon Robert Cook hands me an exhibit, or tells me to turn to an exhibit, and I turn to it, and it's all about his arrest in Wisconsin for the hiring the hitman. And I'm about ready to jump out of my seat. I'm so excited. The judge says, "Mr. Cook, I would reconsider bringing this up if I were you." The judge stepped in. And
yeah,
so he goes,
thank you.
Yeah. And because I almost said, "Oh, you mean this one about your arrest?" I wanted to just throw that out there, but I didn't even get a chance to say that. And then he said, "Okay, no more questions." And then the prosecution said, "No more questions," and which disappointed me because I wanted her to come up and say, "What were you trying to say?" You know. But knowing apparently he was not as hard on me as he was on most people, which is, you know, amazing. And the thing is, these federal judges are appointed for life with no oversight. But the good news is we're gonna kind of skip
but,
the end.
But let me just make one point, is that Cook's overweening theory was that, yes, that's my voice snarling. I was mad. You know, they were dismissive of me. But mainly, when someone says to you, "Hey, heads are going to roll," that means someone's going to get fired. It's not an implicit thing, but he didn't say heads are going to roll. He was just saying, he said things like, "It's going to get bloody," or "I'm going to go postal." He said those are just words.
No.
So the judge actually sent the jury out and said, "You know, this theory has some meaning. I mean, he's only talking about words, and words are not actions." And the judge decided he was going to spend overnight thinking about whether that was going to be an acceptable defense, and also would he allow his prior convictions in. And you told me, I was only there for day one, mm-hmm. that the judge did not allow. So when I, at the end of that day, I told Tricia, I said, "You know, I think given the overwhelming male population on that jury, I'm just concerned if the judge does not allow that in, that there's going to be this guy's going to be running around free."
And that was my concern, too. Here's the thing that I forgot to mention. You know that email I read? The judge disallowed that email and disallowed everything I said about it, but allowed the disclaimer in. I mean, you talk about trying to weight a case. You allow a disclaimer, but you don't allow what they're disclaiming against. It didn't make any sense to me. But the good news is, after all of this, and even Kimberly Stewart thought Commander Stewart thought that it was going to be not guilty. He was found guilty on all three charges. So he's going to go to prison. I know. He's going to go to prison, but I don't know for how long. So
They were estimating that the most he could get is 5 years.
For all
and,
three?
You know,
for all
three
of them?
Yeah, combined.
And see, that's the thing that is very scary to me, because here's the thing. People like Robert Cook give the rest of us who like to go on the internet a bad name, and that's the thing they're going to remember is Robert Cook. So one of the points I wanted to make, and then Mark, we're going to get to you. I'm so sorry. Just hang tight. Don't get mad at me. Don't hang up. But one thing that I wanted to point out is this is why on Web Sleuths we are so adamant about not contacting the police, about not inserting yourself, about not going and talking to witnesses, because we have this horrible misconception about us that we're all crazy like Robert Cook. And Robert Cook used the internet to do his deed on this case. So that is the problem. And again, Donna, I want to thank you so much for being my guide.
Yeah,
in Los
and
Angeles.
I don't know that he's not going to be allowed to use in federal prison the internet.
Unless he
was specifically banned from that he might be, you know, posting away any day now.
Exactly. That's the scary thing. So, Donna, thank you. Hang tight because we're going to talk to Mark Klass now. Before we get to Baby Lisa, and we have some very interesting things to talk about Baby Lisa, and Nurse Be Me is here. She is our moderator on Web Sleuth at the Baby Lisa Forum. Mark, are you still with us?
Yeah, I want to say hi to Mark Klass, too. Mark's the best.
He is. Are you still there?
Hey, Donna. Yeah, hi, Donna. Hi, Tricia.
Hi.
Okay, good.
My suspicion is that when Cook gets to prison, he'll have plenty of opportunities to get enemas.
Right on. Good deal. Okay, Mark, we have a case that you wanted to talk about, and I went online, and I am embarrassed to say I did not know about this, and that is terrible of me. But it is a very tragic case. It's a Jesse, it's pronounced, but it's spelled rather oddly. Jesse Shockley, correct, Mark? Why don't you fill us in on this case?
Well, sure. Jesse Shockley is a 5-year-old black girl that was left inside her home by her mother on the morning of the 11th of October of this year. The mother went to run some errands. There were some older children in the backyard, but apparently Jesse was locked up in the house by herself. When the mother returned sometime later, the door was open, the little girl was gone, and she's not been seen since. There are so many complications in any missing child case, but the family of the little girl has been very pointed in playing the race card in this particular case, and they're saying that the local officials or local authorities are not investigating as much as they would be were she a little white girl. That the media is racially biased, and that basically, you know, everybody's playing the race card on little Jesse. Yet little Jesse remains missing.
So, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I've been asked my take on that, and to an extent I agree, and I think we all have to acknowledge that there is a racial bias in missing child cases, that indeed the ones that get the attention are the pretty little white girls. I don't think anybody would dispute that. But I would go further and say that there's also age bias. There's an age bias with missing children, and there's most definitely a gender bias as well. And I would also suggest that, you know, there's – am I the only one hearing this?
No, I can't. If someone's moving their phone around, whoever it is, you got to stand still or their microphone. Okay, go ahead.
Yes. Anyway, Tricia, there's 2,000 children reported missing in this country every day, and there's only two kids that anybody's talking about right now, and Jesse Shockley is one of them. So I think that really flies in the face of these accusations that are being made by her family, and I think that it speaks well to everybody that there is a real moral investment in the fate of this young girl.
Let me ask you: Didn't her mother get charged and convicted with child abuse? And wasn't there a sex offender living in the house with them?
Yeah, well, that's when they lived in California. The sex offender was the husband of the mother, and indeed, the mother was convicted of child abuse and spent 4 years in a California prison, only to be released, I think, in May of last year. Therefore, when the crime was reported and the police started looking into the history of the family, a decision was made to remove the other children from this mother who has this past conviction and has served prison time for child abuse. And basically, that's where it stands now. The mother says that they wouldn't be looking at her like this if she wasn't black.
Well, that's baloney.
That they should be focusing on bringing the little girl home as opposed to persecuting her. And it's a terrible situation. I don't know that it's tragic yet because we don't know what happened to the child.
Right.
But further complicating it is that the authorities were unable to give the mother a polygraph exam because she was 8 months pregnant.
Oh, dear.
So she's since had that child, and hopefully they'll be able to schedule a polygraph hopefully within the next several days.
She's pregnant after being convicted of child abuse and living with a sex offender, and now her daughter's missing. And it sounds like to me, I'm going to say what everybody's thinking, it sounds like to me she's just using the color of her skin to try and get the suspicion off of her. That's the first thing I would think of. Because of her past and because of all of a sudden playing the race card. You know, it's one thing to play the race card about the media, but it's another thing to place it about the police, because the police have to look at the family first. That's just all there is to it.
Well, that's all true, but, I mean, putting yourself in her shoes, that just may be the way that she was brought up.
Well, that's
true.
There's
a grandmother involved, and she's making many of the same accusations. So, you know, you are what you've learned to be. And if one looks in the world through those tints, or those glasses, then that's going to be probably your excuse for everything.
Well,
what I would say is that I don't think for a second that there's a racial bias against this little girl. I think a lot of people are paying attention to it, and I think an awful lot of people are working very hard to bring her home, and hopefully they'll be able to resolve this sooner rather than later.
Well, Mark, what can we at Web Sleuths do to help? Is there anything we can do?
Well, you know what? You can talk about it. I mean,
we're doing that. We are.
Yeah, no. I mean, that's really the one thing you can do. You can get her picture out there because she's got to be somewhere. There is a resolution to this case. There's always a resolution. So I think that the most any of us can do is bring awareness to the case, which then would hopefully encourage the police to dig a little deeper and investigate a little more. And you know what? Without light, this thing will never be solved. And what you guys can do is help bring light to her pitiful situation.
Tricia?
Yes, go ahead. Kimster.
Yes, this is Kimster. And we do have a picture of Jesse on our front page, front and center. It's been there for a couple weeks now with a link to the area where you can discuss the case. So we have been trying to get her case out there, sometimes in light of the more high-profile cases like Lisa Irwin. We will purposefully put somebody, you know, less profile on the front page. It is on the front page for those who are listening.
Exactly right. And Kimster, thank you so much for doing that. I knew that. And that's true. Once we do try to, especially when there's high-profile cases, because we get so many visitors, we try and put the low-profile cases up there to get the interest in those cases as well.
But that's my point, Tricia. This is a high-profile case now.
Well,
I mean, what other case besides Baby Lisa's is anybody talking about right now?
Well, I haven't seen it national. I haven't seen it national at very much. I mean, I haven't seen it all national, but then again, I could have just missed it.
And that's good, too, but the point, I think the really important point, and this is the thing that everybody overlooks, is that missing child cases are local cases. They are local because they involve a local population. They involve local media, local authorities, and in the vast majority of these cases, the child is going to be located, dead or alive, within just a few miles of the home. So this whole idea that everybody's always focusing on national cases, and getting it on every TV screen, on every channel, is really, for the vast majority of these cases, total and complete overkill.
Well, I see what you're saying. Absolutely. I understand. And the perfect example is Casey Anthony found, 1,500 feet from her home, or Kaylee Anthony found 1,500 feet from her home. It's you're right. But it's what the media is interested in and what gets the ratings, unfortunately, as we know. Right, Mark?
Yep, we know that.
Yeah, it's just too much. Well, I'll tell you what.
Jesse's aunt and grandma were on a couple of TV shows saying that they thought that the mom had some splaining to do, which so Jesse does have some people in her corner, but you know, it's not happening enough. It doesn't seem to be, well, I don't know. I hope it gets solved.
I hope so, too. And you know, we can always hope for the unlikely ending of that she is still alive. Let's hope that is the case. Okay, I know everybody's waiting for this, so we are going to move on to baby Lisa. And, Mark, can you stay with us a little bit longer? That would be great if you could discuss the case with us.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, great, because I know it's been a little bit longer than you had anticipated. And in addition to Mark Klass, we have true crime author Donna Kaufman, and we also have Nurse Be Me, who is an amazing moderator, and she's going to give us kind of a synopsis of the whole case, because there's people listening right now, or that will be listening, that don't know the latest. And don't know the very beginning and don't know the middle. It's a case that is you really have to keep track of because things change very quickly. Also with us is my friend Vicky, and we may go to her, we may not. I'm not sure yet. I just know that she is also quick with the facts. So if we're missing a fact, I'm going to go to her as soon as we can. So, Vicky, you're going to be on the hot seat if we need you, babe. Okay, Nurse Be Me, give us your quick rundown here, please.
Okay, well, the rundown isn't quick because this case is crazy.
I'll tell you what, I may interrupt you a little bit, okay?
Oh, that's fine.
Okay, go for it.
But anyway, the case is very confusing. One of our most recent commenters at Web Sleuths on one of the polls, we've had about four polls there, you know, who did this? Who do you think did this? The closer said, four different polls, I have four different answers.
Speaking of that, I'm going to stop you right there.
Anything.
I'm going to stop you right there. I want to announce the results of the Web Sleuths poll that I put up for Web Sleuths Radio, and the question is, you know, what happened to baby Lisa, and do the parents know what happened to baby Lisa? And the answer, yes, they both know what happened to baby Lisa. That got 32.9% of the vote. Lisa's mom knows, dad doesn't know for certain, but is covering for mom anyway. That got 19.53. And then the next one is Lisa's mom knows, but not her dad. That got 16.51. And then no, they do not know what happened to her. That got 15%. And then let's see, I don't know, got 14.19%. And then finally, Lisa's dad knows, but not her mom, got 2.67%. Okay, go ahead, Nurse Be Me. Continue on with your synopsis.
Anyway, baby Lisa was reported missing on 4 a.m. on October 4th by her father, Jeremy Irwin, on his work cell phone. He'd come home from his first ever night shift. Is that a coincidence or not? As an electrician, to find a disturbed front window, lights on, the front door unlocked, a stray cat in his bed, and his baby missing. Lisa was allegedly last seen by her mother, Deborah Bradley, per her latest statement to the media at 6:40 p.m. on October 3rd when she put her to bed. She was also seen earlier in her crib by a neighbor at 4:30 p.m. This is by a family statement that was just released on Friday. And in some reports, Deborah remembered turning out the lights when she went in. And in other reports, she said she can't remember if she turned the lights out. Much of the same goes on with her statements, with locking the front door, etc. And all of this happened on the first night that her husband ever worked overnight.
That's okay. Let me stop you right there, Nurse Be Me. Mark, you followed this case. You've been commenting on this case on Nancy Grace a lot. Basically, the whole thing just sounds so hinky. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, let's get it straight. That Deborah and Jeremy are not married. Deborah, in fact, is married to somebody else entirely.
Okay,
exactly.
So, I mean, the thing is, if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck and it walks like a duck, pretty soon people are going to come to the conclusion that it's a duck. Now, my guess would be that in the four polls that were taken, that each poll moves a little bit closer to the majority thinking that the parents are involved. And that's because, if that's true, it's because they've done such an effective job of circling the wagons that they've hired outside consultants, they've hired outside law firms, they've stopped talking to anybody in the media, they've cut off total access to themselves or anybody within the family to law enforcement. And it becomes really apparent that, number one, there's no longer a sense of urgency in recovering baby Lisa within that family. Number two, they're much more concerned about their own rights and their own self-interest than they are about the recovery of the little child. Therefore, people are going to continue to skew in that direction. And I would also counter that from everything I've seen, the police seem to be doing a pretty good job of investigating this case. I know that the FBI has been very, very involved in it, and I don't think it would reflect well upon either of these agencies to try to pin it on the mom, as so many people, including the mom herself and her sister-in-law, have been saying over and over again, that in fact they really want to solve this case, that in fact it would be much easier to solve this case if they had the cooperation of the parents and they could run things by the parents, with the exception that if the parents are actually involved themselves. And whether or not they are, I really don't know. But what I do know is they certainly leave that perception.
They do, and that is the perception I have. At the beginning, I didn't. At the beginning, I really thought baby Lisa's parents were totally innocent. Now, I don't think so, but I just don't know. We're talking about the missing baby Lisa Irwin case, and we have on with us Donna Kaufman, the true crime author. We have Mark Klass. We have Nurse Be Me, the amazing moderator, and Kimster, our co-host and executive producer. I love giving her big titles. Okay, Nurse Be Me, go ahead and continue. We've gotten a little bit into the synopsis, so continue on.
Okay, well, anyhow, it kept getting stranger where the parents' statements changed to the media. And I believe it was Mark, you can chime in if you want to, but you said the truth doesn't change. And the truth seems to change here a lot. I don't want to go into a lot of the facts because I don't want to take up all the time, but there were a lot of changing statements that were glaringly obvious.
Nurse Be Me, if you could pick like two of them that were just like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they changed. If you could pick two of those statements, that'd be great.
Okay. The first glaring one to me was one of her versions to the media was that the last time she saw her child, Deborah Bradley, was at 10:30 p.m. after she gave her baby a bottle, she put her to bed. She said this point blank to the media. Then after a surveillance video came out showing her buying a box of wine with her brother in a grocery store, and she went on media saying that I drank in between 5 to 10 glasses of wine and I don't remember when I last saw my child, except I put her in the crib at 6:40 p.m.
Oh, my gosh. That's shocking. Okay.
Those two statements to media shocked me a lot.
Can I just add that a cadaver dog from the FBI hit on the scent of a dead human in the bedroom of the parents?
And Donna Kaufman, true crime author with us tonight. Donna, let me ask you about that. Now, in the Susan Powell case, they brought in 11 different search dogs to see if they would all hit on the same piece of wood that they found in the desert, and they all hit on the exact same place. And the reason why this was, I was told, is because sometimes the handler can kind of, you know, guide a dog or can misread what the dog is saying. So that's why they like to have two or three or more. So 11 dogs in the Susan Powell case, you're pretty darn sure there was decomposing flesh on that piece of burnt wood.
Right, and those were cadaver dogs, not search dogs, yes. Cadaver dogs are so well trained, and they can tell the difference between, menstrual blood and blood from some other means, or animal flesh from human flesh.
What were you going to say, Mark?
I've checked on this with search and rescue personnel, and in fact, one of the reasons they don't bring cadaver dogs into landfills is for the exact reason that they cannot distinguish the difference between different types of blood, that in fact there could have been crap on the floor. That is a form of human decomposition that a cadaver dog very well might be able to hit in. Remember the Haley Cummings situation. Remember they had to check a dumpster, and they thought that they had human decomposition in that dumpster, and it turned out to be it turned out to be tampons. That's one of the problems that exists when using cadaver dogs.
Well, I guess it depends on the training of the dog, but here they had FBI dogs, which are the best of the best.
They also instituted no fly zones over 2 search areas because of the work of the FBI cadaver dogs that were flown in.
So they were really taking extra precautions.
But they didn't want shown on the media.
But here's the thing about that.
And they were also x-raying the house and the walls of the house.
Here's the thing about that cadaver dog hitting. Granted, the dog may be absolutely amazing, but again, if it's just one dog, I would like to see 2 or 3 dogs do the exact same thing. And, Mark, that's interesting. I had no idea that human waste could be misconstrued as human decomposition to a dog. That's very interesting, and I can see where that can cause a lot of problems.
Well, I spoke to Brad Dennis.
The Class Kid Search Director, an amazing man who does have several dogs and definitely knows what he's talking about. But then again, Donna Kaufman, it very well could be that a baby's body was laying right there. Now, another thing I heard, that human decomposition doesn't start, within a few seconds, and it has to be there for an hour for a dog to smell it. I don't think that's true.
Yeah, an hour or more.
Is that true?
I talked to Dr. Wett. He said a couple hours.
Really? See, I had heard it just a few minutes. See, there you go.
Who
knows?
Well, that's when decomp begins, but it's not detectable to a dog.
So the baby would have had to lay there for a while then anyway. Kimster, be looking for questions in the chat room if there are any so that we can ask our guests. So do you know if they took the carpet, Donna? Did they take the carpet that the dog hit on?
No. At last I heard they had not taken a sample of where that was, which was at the end of the bed. Maybe they've done it since.
Wow. Okay, Nurse Phoebe, I'm sorry to keep interrupting, but it's interesting what you're saying, and I my thoughts are just bouncing around in my head like a super ball, and it's my show, and so I can interrupt. So anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead, continue
with
your synopsis.
No, but as for the search and rescue dogs, there is a thread at Web Sleuths where we have 2 verified SAR professionals, and they say kind of the opposite with the cadaver detection. That it can happen within seconds.
See, that's
so,
what I've heard
too. That might be a thread worth checking out.
Absolutely.
For more information.
Absolutely. Okay, we have Nurse Be Me, the amazing moderator on Web Sleuths on the Baby Lisa Irwin case, who's giving us a rundown of what the case is all about, because not everybody knows everything, and unfortunately not everybody can spend all the time on Web Sleuths that they would like. So we're just kind of doing a little synopsis. So why don't you go ahead?
Well, anyway, we were talking about the cadaver dog hit, and this spurred off the first search warrant served in the case per law enforcement, which was on the Irwin and the Bradley home. They spent 17 hours there and took hundreds of x-rays with the Kansas City bomb and arson truck and processed those on the scene. They also took out items out of the home. The other searches that took place during the case have also involved lots of searching with metal detectors. And if you read the search warrant, you can see that obviously law enforcement is very, very interested in the cell phones and any information that they can glean from finding these missing cell phones. There's been very strange accounts from I won't say Jeremy Irwin, but Deborah Bradley, about exactly how these cell phones were working and what she was shown by investigators when they were talking with her.
And what
she
is the difference?
To have
what's
been
going on
shown,
there?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just said what? Explain what's going on there with that.
She claimed to have been shown a cell phone ping chart when she was being questioned. At one point, in fact, one of her first statements to law enforcement or to the media was that the intruders took the cell phone so she couldn't call 911, But then in her next interview, she said that when she was shown the Doppler ping chart, that couldn't be possible because her phones didn't work because she hadn't paid her bill.
Oh, brother.
It begs two different questions right there.
Exactly. Hang tight, Nurse Be Me. Let's go to Kimster. Kimster, we have a question from the chat room for Mark.
Yes, Eli Grandma would like to know if Mark knows why law enforcement would not have done a polygraph on Jeremy in the beginning.
Only if they believe him.
Ah, so they probably, yeah, okay. So they believed him, apparently. Mark, let me ask
you. If his alibi is solid, I could see why they would not. But, you know, he still might know something. I just don't understand why they failed to do that.
That's a very good point. Donna Kaufman, true crime author.
They lawyered up 2 days into the investigation.
There you go. Mark, let me ask you, and this is maybe food for thought for everybody else. Could it just be that this mom was just so drunk, she just has no idea what she was doing, what happened. Her memories are all messed up. She's remembering things from different time frames, and she just doesn't know. Do you think that could be possible, Mark?
She was also on an antidepressant.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, she was on plenty of things that she completely blacked out. Yeah, I think that's quite possible. I don't think that blacking out or doing too much booze or doing too much drugs turns you into a homicidal maniac. But, yeah, absolutely. I think that all kinds of stuff could have gone on around there during that gap of several hours when she was completely zonked for lack of more formal terminology.
Zonk fits it perfectly. Kimster, before we go back to Nurse Be Me, do we have any more questions in the chat room?
Actually, yeah, I have one for Nurse Be Me. This is from Jersey Girl. She wants to know if they took items from the neighbors' homes.
I have not seen where they took items from the neighbor's home, but I know that the neighbor's home was searched.
Okay, Nurse Be Me, go ahead and continue, please, with your synopsis of the Lisa Irwin case.
Okay, so we're on to the cell phone. So in comes the questionable Jersey and his cohort, Megan Wright, she allegedly received a 50-second phone call from the missing Irwin phone or the Bradley phone at 8:30 p.m. on the night of the abduction. This has not been confirmed by law enforcement, but she's done multiple media interviews, and she also claims that her phone has been confiscated by the FBI.
So now that is her neighbor, correct?
No, I need to give a little backstory on this. There is a man in the neighborhood named Jersey who was allegedly last seen around the last time that Lisa Irwin was seen, and he was a handyman in the neighborhood that was suspicious to neighbors, and then all of a sudden he was missing at the same time.
That is interesting.
So
that's very suspicious.
The police were showing photos of this Jersey to all the neighbors. Have you seen this man? They apparently then arrested Jersey on an outstanding warrant, and they also searched a property which was nearby the home where they took out an abandoned well. They checked the whole well, and then they demolished the house. And this was supposedly where Jersey used to live. What is interesting is the person that received this 50-second phone call on the night that baby Lisa went missing was the ex-girlfriend of Jersey.
Oh, okay. That's who she is. Okay. So there is a connection there. But it's not directly to baby Lisa's parents, but it's at this time that we know of, but it's directed to somebody in the neighborhood. Now, that is really very interesting, and I bet there's so much more there. Mark Klass has to leave, so I want to get to Mark just a little bit more before he leaves. And, Mark, thank you for being so patient and hanging on this phone this whole time. You're just such a sweetheart, and we love you so much at Web Sleuths. Kimster, do we have any more questions for Mark? If not, I just have a couple more, and then we will release him.
I have a question from Jersey Girl. She didn't direct it toward anyone, but I think it would be interesting to see what Mark thinks. She'd like to know why Jeremy isn't furious with Deborah, especially after her saying she was drinking and maybe blacked out.
Well, first of all, he seems like a rather of a – he seems like a passive guy, doesn't he? I mean,
yeah.
He's not been demonstrative.
Yeah.
He's not demonstrative in any way, shape, or form during all that. I don't know. I don't know who's I don't know who the dominant personality is in that family. It very well could be her. I would be furious. I wouldn't have done any of the things that Jeremy has done, which, again, is one of the things that just makes it look so bad for them, you know?
Mark, we do have a question from Ann in Texas. Do you think the national media paid Brad or anybody for their information or their pictures? Do you have any information on that?
I have no information at all on that, but I wouldn't be at all surprised. Certain media outlets seem to come up with scoops before others do, and I'm certainly not going to throw any names out here, but anything's possible. Anything's possible. I wouldn't put it past anybody.
Okay, let me ask you one other question. I think this is a couple of people want to know this, but I think we all do. Mark, I know you kind of don't like to be asked this, but I'm going to do it anyway. What do you think happened? If you had to decide right now what happened, what do you think?
Right now, my attention would still be very much on the parents.
On both?
Sure. I mean, okay. They've not been able – well, maybe he more than she, but she certainly has not been able to eliminate herself from suspicion. Her story does continue to change. They don't want to give access to their children. They don't want to give the police access to their children because they say they don't want to traumatize them. But it just seems to me that if a little boy could help his little sister in distress, that that's exactly what he would want to do, that it would ultimately be more distressing to be held silent and to be able to help.
Absolutely.
One thing after another with these folks. And as I said earlier, if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck and talks like a duck, at some point people are going to start believing it is a duck.
Mark, do you think that the police are getting ready to arrest either parent?
Oh, I have no idea. I don't know what's going on inside of that investigation. I'd love to sit at one of the debriefings, though. That would be amazing.
That would be wonderful. Well, Mark, go ahead.
Well, we don't know what the cops are doing because everything that we've heard has come from the Irwin Bradley team, and that means even the drinking. Maybe she wasn't drinking at all. You know, maybe that's just an excuse so she can feign not remembering things. The cop
yep.
who went to the house initially is going to know that. Was she drunk at the site? Did they give her a test or notice that she was drunk? The other thing, frankly, we can't eliminate is that there was an accident that could have involved the kids, the boys in the house, the 6 and 8 year old, I think 6 and 8. There could have been an accident. There could have been something like that, and this is all just a giant cover-up.
And we've seen that before. Mark, listen, we're going to let you go. Thank you so much for staying on as long as you did and for hanging in there with us. Everybody at Web Sleuths just adores you, and we appreciate everything you do. And I hope you know that we are here to help class kids and you in any possible way that we can. Give my love to Violet, okay?
All right. I adore you. You're great. Thanks, Tricia. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye, Mark.
So long.
Okay. It's just the chicks now, the hot, kick-ass chicks. Okay. Let's see. Donna? No, wait. Hold on. Nurse, be me. I have a question for you, okay? You said that Jersey lived in what house?
He was apparently, according to a bar owner by the name of One-Eyed Jack's, which is right near the house, squatting in a house which was nearby the house that was demolished and searched.
Oh, okay, so he was squatting. It wasn't like he was living there and paying rent or anything.
With his girlfriend, which we now know to be Megan Wright.
The one who got the phone call.
The pink-haired
okay.
girl. And she said that there were 8 people in the house, and although it was her cell phone, they all shared that cell phone. And she also said that somebody told her that her phone number was on Lisa Bradley's hand, but I don't know if that's factual.
Very interesting. Okay, so we're continuing on with the timeline in the Lisa Irwin case. We have moderator Nurse Be Me from Web Sleuth, who is giving us this wonderful timeline, and we left off with the cell phones, the missing cell phone. So go ahead and take it, my dear.
Well, almost all of the searches have used metal detectors, so obviously law enforcement does not have these cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
You would take it from Deborah Bradley seeing a ping chart, unless they were playing her, that law enforcement does have some record of some phone calls, although they're not confirming them.
Okay.
So the cell phones are of great interest. They're also listed on the search warrant, which you know can be read at all of the local media news sites. Most of them have the search warrant posted there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The greatest thing in this case is that the parents have quit cooperating with law enforcement since about the 6th of October, which was 2 days after the baby went missing.
Now, wait, I thought they said they were cooperating and it was the police that misunderstood, or is that not right?
I guess it's who you believe.
Mm-hmm.
The police, I have never seen this happen in a case, but the police actually, like an hour after an earlier press conference to discuss the case, an hour later, they held another press conference stating that, declaring and announcing that the parents were no longer cooperating with law enforcement.
Right.
I've never seen something like it. They continue to say this, and as recently as yesterday said, I mean, their only statement to the media was that the parents are still not cooperating with investigators.
And when was that?
That was yesterday.
Okay, and the police said yesterday, the parents are still not cooperating. Okay. Kimster, do we have any questions in the chat room yet?
No, I don't have any right now.
Okay, well, let's just listen to this timeline because I find it very, very interesting. Continue on, my dear.
Okay, so now do we go to the bald man carrying the baby sightings?
Yes.
Okay, so we now have Jersey. We have Megan Wright. We also move on to what the lawyers for the family have really focused on, and that are these bald man with a baby sighting.
Mm-hmm.
So at midnight, which is roughly 4 hours before Lisa Irwin went missing, roughly 30 minutes after the neighbor claims that she last was standing outside of the residence, there is a sighting of a bald man with a baby in the neighborhood. A bald man carrying a baby in a diaper on a cold night. If you
weird.
Look at the most recent video footage of Jersey, he's a bald guy. So law enforcement has said that they're moving on from Jersey, but he's definitely a bald, skinny guy. At 2 a.m., just a little bit more up the neighborhood, up north ways, there is an unknown figure. It's unknown watching the video footage if it's a man or a woman or if it's carrying anything. The arms seem to be swinging. It looks like a blob. But this figure emerges from a wooded area. So that was at 2 a.m. Then at 4 a.m., another mile north, which is around the same time that Lisa was actually reported missing on the 911 call, is a guy on a motorcycle seeing a bald man carrying a diaper-clad baby.
Mm-hmm.
So we have those three sightings.
So, okay, so let me ask you, Nurse Be Me, is everybody now thinking it's Jersey and it had nothing to do with the mom, or what are people thinking?
I I think it just throws some confusion into the mix.
Okay, let's go to Donna Kaufman, true crime author and my personal tour guide in Los Angeles while I was there last week. Donna, what do you think about this? This is very interesting that different people are spotting a bald guy with a baby in diapers, or could it just be this, you know, they want to join in and now they're just making it up? I don't know.
Well, the couple that first saw the person closer to midnight and the other guy, the single guy who was on the motorcycle, lived 90 miles away, which is why he didn't realize that he should have reported this sighting a lot sooner. He waited a week. They seem credible, but nobody has asked them, even though they've both been very forthcoming on interview shows, to describe the clothing. White T-shirt, yeah, but the couple said that the person was wearing light sweatpants. We don't know what the other person saw, sweatpants. And I would like to know if the baby was in any kind of a holder or a baby Bjorn or something like that. Were the man's arms free or was he cuddling the child?
Right.
And also there's nothing to suggest that that baby was alive that I've heard. You know, could the child have died in an accident and a phone call was made to somebody, come and get this body and get rid of it, you know, I'm sorry to say, but and take the cell phones too, because then no one's going to know that I called you to say come and get the body.
Mm-hmm.
So that, not realizing that it takes time to get the cell phone records, but the cell phone records will reveal if calls were made. So it's interesting that nothing else was taken from the house. No,
can I just
bottles,
chime in
no
there off of you?
Yes, go ahead. Nurse Phoebe, go ahead.
One of the phones, I mean, I find that very interesting, and I just, that just struck me as being a possibility, because one of the phones apparently was given to Deborah Bradley by her father, another family member, because one of her family phones was broken. So it is quite well that one of those phones had service to it, if it was given to her by someone else.
I just want to jump in here. Trin Trin is saying, it is being reported now in the mainstream media, the motorcycle guy identified the neighbor guy as who he saw walking with the baby. Who's neighbor guy?
The neighbor guy is
the drinking partner that Deborah alleges she was on the porch with.
Okay.
It was involved in a domestic incident with her husband, and they lived next door, and the husband had left the building, had left the household. So the sighting, it says it matches him.
Oh, my goodness. You know what? Could it get any more of a...
That was at 5 p.m. This was like the guy left the house at 5 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
of the same night that the baby, you know, vanished.
Does the term Mongolian cluster mean anything to anybody? This is just absolute... I'm just... My head is spinning. I'm like, there's Jersey, bald guy, and... Oh, my God. Okay. Anyway... So, Nurse Phoebe, go ahead. We're getting to it here. Go for it, my dear.
We're getting to it. Where were we?
let's see. We were with the identification of the people who saw the guys walking with the dead baby. With the baby that appeared not to be living. It didn't look like it was living. Isn't that what they said?
No, nobody has characterized the child as moving or. We don't know if the
animated.
Face was toward the guy's chest or if the face was looking out. You know, that hasn't been clarified.
They couldn't tell. Okay. So, okay, go ahead.
Well, they should know if
their
hands were both free.
Well, that's true. I don't know. Go ahead, Nurse Mimi.
Well, anyway, I think then the rest of the case is just a bunch of lawyer posturing.
Mm-hmm.
We had a local attorney on the case. Then we have a high-profile defense attorney from New York, Joe Tacopina, came in, along with a private investigator and talking head for the media, Bill Stanton. They came in, an anonymous private benefactor put up a $100,000 reward for the safe
Which
return and the conviction.
Offered, yeah.
Sorry?
Which is still being offered. There's something
yes,
Robert
it's
Cook
still
would
being
get
offered.
Involved with.
Yeah, this is, we should turn Robert Cook onto this. No, we shouldn't. They don't need it, believe me.
But Cindy Short, in her press conference...
People are talking over each other. Okay, Donna, go first.
Okay, sorry.
And then,
I'm sorry.
That's good.
I just want to add one thing to what Nurse Mimi was saying was prior to Joe Tacopino getting involved, the New York attorney that we know represented Bjorn Vandersloot in his and you know, some other people. He's a good defense attorney. There was a woman named Kathleen Zellner who was a Chicago hardcore defense attorney from Chicago who made a huge award from the Will County, the citizens of Will County who paid off her clients to the tune of $14 million when she proved that Kevin Fox did not kidnap his own daughter, Riley Fox, who was a two-year-old who went missing and was found dead. He confessed in police custody. They kept him locked up for a while, and she proved that it wasn't him, and another person has been convicted. So they made a huge amount. You know, I wondered if she's not the source of that $100,000 reward, but, you know, who knows that no one's taking. So anyway, she was doing some press for this, and then abracadabra, she disappeared and was replaced by Tacopino. I don't know what happened there.
Okay.
But she would be a good person to be involved in this case. It certainly, her experience is more of that nature than Tacopino's is.
Okay, Nurse B. May, continue on, please, my dear. You were going to say something?
I was just going to speak about Cindy Short and what she had to say about it. She had a completely different take on the whole lawyer split deal and essentially said that, you know, they just didn't agree and that Tacopino was the one who canceled the interviews, the forensic interviews with the boys. And if we go back to what was said about what the boys heard, if you go back to Deborah Bradley's interview, she said that the boys heard noises and that she never asked them about it. And then Bill Stanton, the private investigator, says that the boys described the sounds they heard as clicking noises.
Clicking noises.
So, yeah, my question is, what did the boys hear? And if your kid was abducted out of your house, would you not, the first thing that you would do, go and ask your children, what did you hear?
Oh, hell yes. Absolutely.
Okay,
and I love
to
talk
to the boys are locked to ask them. At this point.
I'm sorry, what, Nurse
Mimi?
What did you say, Nurse
Mimi? She did not do this. She said she was scared to talk to them.
Weird. Okay.
Didn't want to bring it up with them.
And Donna, what were you going to say?
Well, that is suggestive to me of some involvement possibly with the boys, because the boys, a month later, getting nothing but their mother and father's respective parents' views of the case, I don't think they're going to be able to give anything that is of any worth to law enforcement if they are investigated. The time to have investigated them was the day that it happened,
right?
When it was all fresh in their mind before they had been, you know, given talking points.
They've been able to get their stories straight. Nurse Mimi, how old are the boys again?
The boys, I believe, are 6 and 8. I'm sure a poster will correct me if I got that wrong.
Okay, but old enough that an accident could happen with a baby.
Yes.
Okay, so go ahead.
Furthermore, about the boys, they have yet to reschedule the interview that they said that they would reschedule with the boys. And one of the statements in the search warrant when for probable cause when was when investigators said that Deborah Bradley said that she was afraid what she would find behind the house when she was asked why she didn't look for the baby.
Whoa.
Which is a wooded area, not unlike what Casey Anthony's parents lived around.
Right.
You know, it's a very woodsy community there.
Right.
That is bizarre. Okay, now let's do this. We probably should wrap it up here in a little bit. And Donna, we need to talk a little bit about Rebecca's case as well. But before we get off baby Lisa Irwin, Kimster, do we have any more questions from the chat room?
No, I don't have any for you.
Okay, let me talk to Nurse Be Me. Nurse Be Me is the fabulous moderator, head moderator of the Baby Lisa Irwin Forum. Nurse Be Me, where do we stand today? What is the latest, if you had to give a summary on the news tonight of today's latest updates, what would be the latest on the Baby Lisa Irwin case?
I have 7 points for you, Tricia.
I'm ready. Let's hear all seven.
Okay, well, number one, law enforcement stated Friday that the parents are still not cooperating with investigators.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, this is just a rehash, that law enforcement did try in vain to reproduce a break-in scenario involving the window as the point of area,
mm-hmm.
Point of entry early on in the case. They're still following down tips and leads. As of Friday, they cleared 900-odd tips, and there's like a total of 1,100.
Mm-hmm.
They're still actively investigating the case. This is number four, is my most important one, is law enforcement states they have collected evidence of value in their searches but will not elaborate on what it is.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Number five is that the grand jury is being used as a tool. There was an earlier subpoena for the media to submit family footage, raw footage,
mm-hmm.
to the grand jury. It's clearly being used as an investigative tool in the case.
Right.
Number six point is there's no named suspects.
Mm-hmm.
And number seven is where's baby Lisa?
Boy, that's the big one.
That's the big one.
Okay, Nurse Be Me, I'm going to put you on the spot, even though I shouldn't. I'm a bad owner, bad form owner, bad, bad girl. What do you think happened?
Well, given the neighborhood, given what's going on, I don't know. I'm still up on the fence. There's bald guys, there's phones, there's...
Exactly. There's who knows what. I'm with you.
There's
I'm right up there with
what.
You. Well, I just want to thank you personally, Nurse Be Me, and all the moderators who are moderating the Lisa Irwin Forum. It's a tough, tough job, and Nurse Be Me, you do a fantastic job.
May I ask Nurse Be Me a question?
Sure.
I have one question, if I could. I saw footage of police recreating how somebody could get into the window, and it seems
mm-hmm.
to me one would need to have pretty awesome upper body strength to hike up to that window, because there's nothing underneath it. There's something that, like, you wrap hoses around, it seems. Is that sturdy enough to stand on and boost oneself up through that window, or is that just, not really an entry point and not reliable? And one would think that if somebody was going to do that, they wouldn't do it on a window that faces the street, and that they might have tried the door first, which was unlocked.
Okay, here's my answer to that. I've heard from the locals, and they say that the neighborhood is like a labyrinth of streets. Like, you don't just drive through that neighborhood. You would have to be in there for a reason. There were also mm-hmm. people allegedly out in front of the house for a long period of time that night, and the window sat high up. And then you also have Jeremy Irwin's embellishment on the cobweb story, where he said he saw a cobweb wound up in the window. So I don't think the window was the point of entry at all.
Yeah, because somebody, especially if it was a disheveled person who was not a cat burglar, who knows how to dress and not leave evidence, you're going to be leaving fingerprints, palm prints, shoe prints, and any hairs and fibers would be possible as you heist yourself up and hoist yourself up and go through that window and push the screen.
Let me
exactly.
jump in here. Kimster, we have a question for Nurse Bimi, did you say?
Yes, Lone Traveler wants to know, if there was an actual window in Lisa's room before the disappearance, was there glass behind the black plastic or just an opening?
I'm not sure, but that is a very good question, because in pictures of the video tour of the home, there are black garbage bags taped over the window of the room, and I don't know if that was due to luminol testing. When I watched the live search, I saw people go in with pink spray bottles, and I know that that tour was taken after that investigation, so I wouldn't know.
Okay.
And also, what I understand is that window is substantially higher because of the sloping of the backyard, and so
oh,
it would
the,
be
the back
extra
window
hard.
Is very high. You would need a pole vault and a trampoline to get in that window.
Okay, here we go. I'm going to put Donna Kaufman, true crime author, on the spot now. Donna, what do you think happened to baby Lisa Irwin?
Well, I will say, without knowing what the police know, you know, it's just kind of an ignorant guess. But based on everything that we've heard, it indicates to me that there could be an accident and a cover-up. And, you know, so beyond that, I don't know. It reminds me an awful lot, though, of the baby Sabrina Eisenberg case
yes.
of 1997 in Florida, where the child was allegedly kidnapped from her crib while the family and the dog slept. There was a dog also in this house that slept through this burglar.
Right.
And also, why would you go in there and turn on all the lights? I mean, does that make any sense? This guy's going to lose his
sense.
Burglar union card.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's really hinky to me. And I wish that there were. But, you know, the other thing, to be fair, you look at the footage of Lisa Irwin as a child, you know, even younger, and she's always clean. She's well-dressed. She's got lots of different clothes. The mother seems to dote on her, you know, so she doesn't look like it's an abusive household.
Okay, on that, we're going to move off the baby Lisa case for just a little bit. Nurse Bimi, stay on with me, because we are going to talk briefly about what we're going to talk about next week. And Donna Kaufman is going to be joining us and helping us, and there is a very interesting Dr. Phil interview coming up, and this all has to do with the strange death of Rebecca Zahow. And why don't you give us the 411 on that, my dear?
Well, on Tuesday's Dr. Phil show, there will be a show and tell with Rebecca Zahow's family and her two attorneys, the family's attorneys, Ann Bremner from Seattle and Marty Rudoy from Los Angeles. And on satellite will be Dr. Cyril Wecht, with whom I co-wrote two books, A Question of Murder, and more recently, From Crime Scene to Courtroom. And Dr. Wecht conducted an autopsy on Rebecca Zahow, who, as you will remember, was a 32-year-old female who lived in the San Diego Spreckles mansion with her multimillionaire boyfriend, Jonah Shacknai. And it was a summer home. Their main home was in Arizona. And 2 days before Rebecca's death, his six-year-old son, Max, and this goes back to July, fell over a balcony and suffered a head injury and was eventually taken off life support. He never recovered. And so that, with that in mind, 2 days later, Rebecca is also dead, and she is found hanging from a balcony in the mansion. And so Dr. Wecht looked at, made independent findings about her injuries. The law enforcement of the Coronado PD, which is a small beachfront community in San Diego County, they referred it immediately to San Diego sheriffs, and the autopsy was done by San Diego coroner's office. And, you know, no one's picking on those agencies, but the thought is perhaps they determined this to be a suicide before looking at the full breadth of the investigation. So there's a lot more information that the family has been attempting to gather, and Dr. Phil actually paid for the his show, paid for the exhumation of Rebecca's body, which was buried in St. Joseph, Missouri, where her parents and sister live, to be flown to Pittsburgh, where Dr. Weck conducted the second autopsy. So I believe, and I don't know all the facts, you know, I'm waiting for Tuesday as well, but there will be a real showdown of where the case is now. And if this is a case that you're involved or interested in, and it really is, was it a suicide or was it murder or something else? It really pay attention, and perhaps you can help out the family, which is trying to raise money on various websites to pay for the kinds of investigation you need to really get into this in a private way. Dr. Weck, by the way, did volunteer his services. But hiring the kinds of help that you need for a case like this is expensive. And, you know, the family is adamant that she had no reason to commit suicide. And the timeline is something that they will get into, I suspect. And it's compelling.
Well, thank you, Donna. We look forward to that next week. And to Dr. Phil, on Tuesday, did you say?
This coming Tuesday, yes.
This coming Tuesday, the Rebecca Zahow case. It's going to be very interesting. We'll be discussing that next week. We'll also have Cynic on with us, who is a Rebecca Zahow expert, as well as Donna Kaufman. Donna, I didn't know if you realize this, but you're going to be on next week, too. I don't know if I told you that yet.
Oh, yeah. Are you guys sick of me yet?
Yeah, not yet. And I do like Mark Klass does. Mark Klass, he just does what I tell him. He always says, I just do what I'm told.
Yeah, right.
Good boy, good boy. Okay, now we have one final thing, and this is very exciting. Our moderators on Web Sleuth, honest to goodness, they are the most amazing people, and they're always trying to think of ways to improve the forum to make it better for you, the member or the reader of Web Sleuth. And Kimster has come up with a great idea, and it has been put together. And Kimster, I'm going to turn the floor over to you, my dear.
Yay, Kimster.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for giving me the credit, but I have to admit it was a brainstorming idea that Bessie and Salem and I think Salem also had. And so we have started a new forum. It is called the Serial Killer Forum. You'll find it just below the Cold Case Forum. Bessie and Harmony, too, and I have been organizing this new forum. So as you go in, you'll just see it improving day by day. I can't believe the number of hours that Bessie's been putting in, especially in the Killing Field area. There's a sub-forum there about the Killing Field there. There's one
and
about
what is
the
Killing Field?
The Killing Field is an area in League City, Texas, mm-hmm. where they have found a lot of bodies over many, many years, and one of them being Tim Miller's daughter. Mm-hmm. And they still have not found that serial killer. So there's forums in there about serial killers that have been caught, and there's some, you know, where they're still trying to find out where some of the victims might be. It's an interesting forum because it's integrated also in with our unidentified forum, people that tend to like to go in there and try to find the identity of remains will be also going to the serial killer forum for information and things like that, and the cold case forum. So they kind of are all moving together. But the serial killer forum will leave those, will be unique in that we'll have these certain areas where if they find an unidentified, they could go, wow, can we link that to that serial killer? Mm-hmm. And if so, I mean, because sometimes in these serial killer cases, the serial killer will say, well, yes, I killed so-and-so, but I don't remember where she is. They won't tell anybody where the remains are.
Right.
So if the remains are found in an area and somebody's working in the unidentified forum, they can now go to the serial killer forum because we are going to identify that by states and things like that. So it's going to be a great resource. I've seen, even though we haven't announced it yet, this is the first time we've announced it, I've seen a lot of our members going in there and a ton of visitors. So I think it's going to be a very resourceful forum for trying to solve some more cases. But I'll tell you what, it is scary in there, Tricia.
It's scary.
And
why is
it
scary?
It's
scary in there, and I don't want you leaving me in there for long periods of time, because I'll tell you what, these are some really creepy people. And
very creepy, very scary.
I am very thankful there aren't a whole bunch of them out there, but there's a lot more than
Nurse
I realize.
You better take Mimi in with you just to be sure.
Yeah, she can help you if something happens.
Yeah, bring her really long needle with her.
Hey.
But yeah, it's really creepy in there. But I'd like to, I think we talked about it, we're going to have some guests in the future that have worked on some of these cases, mm-hmm. and we'll be talking a lot more about it in the future. So come on in and join us, and if you see some areas that we can combine, because we're still, some of the issues that we're having right now is we're not sure if some of these cases kind of go together. So, you know, let us know. Help the moderators out. Just use your little alert button. That's a little red triangle in the top right corner of the post, and let us know if you can help us with some organizing. We'd really appreciate it there. Thank you.
Thank you. And here's the thing. I'm going to make a prediction here, and this is going to be kind of creepy. But I predict, and I don't know when it's going to happen, it might be years down the road, but I predict a serial killer is going to come on Web Sleuth and read and post, and we'll find out about it. Just, I don't know why, I think that's going to happen. You know, because they're so, a lot of them are so egotistical.
I believe it.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
they would want to read about themselves. Donna, what do you think?
Oh, absolutely, the narcissism. I wouldn't be surprised if Web Sleuth solves more cases, too. I know you've already had some great successes, but
yes. What
a marvelous tool and environment you have given to law enforcement and to victims' families and just people who want to learn how to stay safe and keep their families safe. On all levels, Web Sleuth is it.
Well, thank you, Donna. And, you know, you've been a big part of helping dispel that that stupid image that John Ramsey started of us, of beer can collectors
and board
housewives. You know, like saying someone's a housewife is a bad thing. That just shows what an idiot he is. But thank you, Donna. Thank you so much, because I know you really go out there and sing Web Sleuth's praises to law enforcement and to people in all types of law enforcement. So thank you so much. And thank you for being on the show.
I thank every single member who has posted there and who reads there, and particularly you, Tricia Griffith, and the moderators. Fantastic all the way around.
Thank you. And we're going to keep plugging away. Nothing's going to stop us. Donna Kaufman, true crime author, the latest book from Crime Scene to Courtroom with Dr. Cyril Wex. That was my dog in the background, in case you heard that yawn. I don't have a human here yawning in my face. Thank you, Donna Kaufman, for coming on. Nurse Be Me, what can I say? You are amazing in many, many ways. Thank you for your wonderful synopsis of the Lisa Irwin case. We appreciate it. Kimster, thank you so much for holding everything together and making everything work. You are just a doll. Thanks to Mark Klass, and thank you to our sponsors. Web Sleuth Radio is brought to you by a great organization called DreamCatchersForAbusedChildren.com. This is a nonprofit organization where their mission is to educate the public on abuse, symptoms, interventions, and preventions. Be sure and visit them at DreamCatchersForAbusedChildren.com. Web Sleuth Radio, we're discussing true crime, current events, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everyone.
Good night.